I got to tell you, this is nerve-wracking. I'm scared to death. I can't believe it. I'm so glad I'm talking about something like devotion and rituals. Very unnerving. I heard it when I was listening to Carrie's Dhamma talk. I could hear it in her. It's like, oh my goodness, I totally understand. So you guys know we're talking about rituals and devotion. And this month, the next month, we're going to talk about social justice. And these two topics, they are so close to my heart. They're so close to my heart because oftentimes I don't think we realize how much these two topics have to do with our everyday, ordinary life. And so when Tim and I were sitting there, we're like, what do we deal with every day? These are the two topics that I really wanted to spend time on because I think this month we're going to see how rituals and devotions impact us, but also how social justice impacts us next month. And it's not just that it impacts us because we have it. It's both when we can feel into these topics and when we feel the absence of these topics that make them so impactful. Okay, but we're going to talk about rituals and devotion. I'm really glad that Carrie agreed to do the first talk. It was so perfect. And the way that she looks at devotion as, what did she call it? It's an expression of our honor and respect. I love it because in a way, many people hold devotion in that way. And so the things that we honor and respect, we feel worthy of honor and respect. That's what she said. It's the expression of things we feel worthy of honor and respect. That is what we're devoted to. And it could be anything. It doesn't have to be some spiritual path. It could be anything. And then Lindo, you know, when I first asked her, she's like, I don't have any devotion. I can't do it. it was so sweet. I'm like, you're perfect. Because many people think like that, right? I don't have no devotion. I don't do that ritual stuff. I don't wanna. And yet when I listened to her talk, the way that she expressed it as part of everyday life, then it becomes important. You can begin to see there's something that we're pointing to, and I'm gonna express it in an even different way. There's something that we're pointing to that I think Mary Oliver's asking, this idea of what is it exactly that we're pointing to when we think about rituals and devotion. So I thought tonight I would talk about it a little bit and talk about some of the pitfalls, the way I perceive it. And then next week we'll have a summary and then kind of open it up a little bit more, the implications of that. And then I thought on the very last Monday, because this happens to be five Mondays, on the very last Monday, I thought we should talk about some actual practices, some devotional practices, maybe even chant a little, things like that. Do the thing that we never do ever. And only because we have a fifth Sunday, we can actually do it. So that's what I'm thinking that we'll do. But I want to start by going back to last year. And last year I started working with Nibbana. I don't know if some of you guys know, but every year I pick something to practice with, and then I practice with it the whole year. And then I put together a non-residential, and then I go various sanghas and teach this non-residentials, mostly online now. But I picked talking about Nibbana and what exactly is Nibbana. And then I go and do these non-residentials around Nibbana. But something struck me when I started practicing with Nibbana. This was before Tim and I even started talking about what we were going to have as a topic. And I was beginning to see that Nibbana, this awakening that we talk about all the time, is way out there. I mean, it's way out there. It's out there in the realm of what is prayer. So I thought I would share a little bit of some of the stuff I found. This might seem like it's a long ways from devotion, but I think I can explain why I want to start here with Nibbana. The first thing I want to share is this little short sutta that the Buddha, it's called one of the talks on unbinding or Nibbana. And so it says here that the Buddha was staying at the Savatthi at Jetta's Grove. And on this occasion, he was instructing, urging, arousing, and encouraging the monks, the nuns, I'm assuming, with Dhamma talk concerning what is unbinding. And the monks were in this receptive, kind of attentive mode, and focusing their entire awareness, lending an ear and listening to the Dhamma. So when the Buddha realized the significance of that, he told them this. He said, "There is, monks, an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unfabricated. If there were not that unborn, unbecome, unmade, unfabricated, there would not be the case that escape from the born, the become, the made, the fabricated would be discerned. But precisely because there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unfabricated, then escape from the unborn, become, made, I mean, escape from the born, become, made, and fabricated is discerned." When I first read that, I had no idea what this is. I'm now reading it now for several times, and I still have no idea. There's something that I know this is pointing to, but I don't have any idea what it is. I know there is a something here, but basically there's a level of blindness or confusion that I don't understand about. So here's another one. This is a conversation that the Buddha had with a Brahmin named Fatya. It was a long, long, long conversation, but I want to give you a little piece of it. And Fatya says, "But Master Gotama," like Buddha, the monk whose mind is thus released, it is this. The monk's whose mind has gotten here. Where does he reappear?" And the Buddha's response was, "Reappear, Vacha? It doesn't apply." So then Vacha goes, "Well, in that case, Master Gotama, does he not reappear?" And Buddha said, "Does not reappear, Vacha? Doesn't apply." So then I guess Vacha asked him, "Well, does he do both? Does he both appear and not appear?" And the Buddha said, "Doesn't apply." He said, "Oh, okay, maybe it's neither here nor there. Is that it?" The Buddha said, "Doesn't apply." So Vacha now says, "Well, how is it, Master Gotama, when I asked you if the monk reappears, does not appear, both appears and doesn't appear, neither appears, you say it doesn't apply in each case. At this point, I am befuddled. At this point, I'm confused. And the modicum of clarity coming to me from your earlier conversation is now obscure. So I'm kind of lost in the whole thing." And this is what Buddha said. "Of course you are befuddled, vajra. Of course you're confused. Deep vajra is this phenomenon, hard to see, hard to realize, tranquil, refined, beyond the scope of conjecture, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. And then he goes on and talks a little bit more about it. But the reason why I wanted to start there is that when it comes to this practice, there is a big valley between the ordinary and the sublime. And if we try to only learn the ordinary, then we stay kind of in a foggy, simplified version of what's possible with Dhamma. But if we are truly seeking liberation, then we are going to have to go into an understanding that's far beyond our current understanding. We have to begin to think about entering into a realm that we have no current understanding right now. And there is nothing in our world that's going to help us get that understanding. So what we need is a faith, if you will, trust in something we don't see and can't see. I trust this sutta on the unbinding, but I have not. Okay. All right, so we're going to try this again. Too weird. Anyway, it's probably good that I had that whole interruption there. So I can really just settle down a little bit. The whole thing is unnerving. So, let me see if I can find the gallery. Okay, there you are. So if this were just self-help, if getting to this unbinded kind of awakening, if the whole practice, if we could just get there by applying some simple little steps, then we kind of know this. I mean, how many of us have read books on the 7 behaviors of highly effective people, or learned leadership skills, or, you know, organizational skills? And I can even remember when I was a lawyer, I was so, the level of work I had to do was so difficult that we were taught time management, and it worked. I mean, the way they taught us to manage our time, it actually helped us manage our caseloads. And my whole experience as a trial lawyer was much better because I learned that skill. But the difficulty is that what we are practicing with, what we are learning in practice in Dhamma, the Buddha called abstruse. Abstruse, that's what he called it. Sublime. It's beyond our view. So if we're going to learn something that's beyond our view, then we have to learn this a different way. And this is what I think rituals and devotions help us with. We are learning something in a different way, not in the standard ordinary way that we learn things. So I think the practice itself is about finding this understanding. So part of the way that we find this understanding is that we have to begin to make every single thing in our lives sacred. Everything has to be sacred. Not just part of it sacred. Everything has to be sacred. Meaning that even the habits that we wish we never did, they have to be sacred. Because if they're sacred, then we're not upset or averse to dealing with them. Everything has to kind of line up and come onto the path. And if it comes onto the path, whatever it is, and we practice with it, we can begin to see some things. So what I think devotions and rituals do is they cut away this first layer of what I would call the ordinary delusion. There's a basic layer of delusion that we kind of walk around life with. What Mary Oliver pointed to as she can walk through the world along the shores and under the trees with my mind filled with things of little importance in full self-attendance, a condition I can't really call being alive. There's a way that we kind of move through our world in the ordinary sense in that kind of a state. But as practitioners, there is another way to move through the world, same world, but we move through that world with a level of sacredness that turns everything we see. Her seeing that wren in the bushes was enough to get her to bring her attention to it, perched, ready to connect. So I thought I would talk about the three levels of distortion or delusion where rituals and devotion, I think, really help shift our understanding. And the first is, it's connected to, it's called our self-identity. So there's a way that we obsess over ourselves, our lives, our way of being, our habits, and we see ourselves as a permanent person. Like, I am Tuere, and this is how I am, and this is how I always am. And when we see ourselves in that ordinary sense, we cannot see beyond that. We can't see beyond who I am, and we can't see beyond the possibility of who I could be. But in the realm of the sublime and the realm of heart to see, the realm of wisdom, the realm of liberation, the possibility that I could be awakened is always right there. So how do I see myself as the possibility of being awakened when I am in the midst of some habit that is destructive and I hate it? I wish I wouldn't do it. And I do it all the time, and I have this sense about me. When we put rituals and devotion around that habit and hold it in a sacredness, then all of a sudden, these habits and behavior patterns that we have begin to change their nature. So an example would be, if you get irritable, judging, angry, of that nature, you're just always, that's just the way I've always been my whole life. If you begin to bring the sacredness of metta into that, not metta just saying words by rote, but bring the sacredness of metta into the moment that we have some irritation, it changes our relationship with that moment. It changes our relationship completely. I don't know how to describe it, because you actually have to be in the moment of irritation and bring metta into it for you to see that which is hard to see. But the pitfall is that oftentimes when people come and talk to me about not accessing metta, it doesn't feel right, it doesn't work, is because they're trying to just say the phrases by rote, just say the phrases. And we can get caught in thinking that the phrases is what's going to end up letting go of the irritation or letting go of my anger or somehow changing, as if the devotion itself, the practice itself, is what's going to change everything. But that's not actually what I think the ritual and devotion aspect of our everyday life is pointing to. I think it's pointing more to our ability to just feel into the sacredness of even our most difficult habits. And the ritual and devotion is how we're able to feel into it. I mean, you could think of this another way. If there really was no liberation of the mind, if we really couldn't liberate our mind, if there was no Nibbana, there was no possibility of something more than my judging, critical mind, then if you happen to be born in a house full of a mess, you are in trouble. You're kind of like stuck with it. If you were born or something happened to you in your life that caused you to have a lot of anger, you are pretty much stuck with it. Can you see that? Like, we would be left to have to put up with whatever habits we have, whatever destructive patterns we have, we would pretty much have to put up with it if there was no possibility of liberation. So even though each of us as an individual may have no idea what liberation is or how to access it, as long as we believe that it's possible, then that gives us a path to want to walk towards it. And the only way, in the midst of some destructive habit, some self-identified reactivity, that we can begin to approach that subject is that reactivity has to be sacred. It has to be a part of a sacred understanding. And that it is equally, our reactivity has to be equally important, honorable, worthy of our honor and respect as everything else, as every good quality, as the poems that we read from people who speak of beautiful things. They're not really speaking of the ugly things, but the ugly things have to be sacred also. And when they're sacred, then we can earnestly apply a devotional practice to help us remember that they're sacred. There's another level of delusion that we walk around in. It's not just our sense of obsession about ourselves, but there's another level of delusion we walk around with, and it is doubt. Just a kind of a hidden secret doubt in the, I guess you could say, maybe the truth of this unbinding, or maybe even, okay, I believe there's a liberation and awakening is possible, but not me. Or maybe I believe that one day in some lifetime, maybe, but not this lifetime. I mean, there's a way in which we treat the possibility of actually liberating the mind as so far removed from us that, again, we can't really access it as a part of our everyday life, our ordinary way of being and moving in the world. So I know last week Linda was saying that I really think that devotional practice is what connects us to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. It is. To me, every single person who's a practitioner has to come to their own understanding of who we each feel the Buddha is. Who is he to us? We each have to come to an understanding. Like I know for myself, when I first had this thought, I don't know how it is that it came to me, but I remember having this thought that the Buddha was actually dying before he awakened. So he was actually dying, and then he had some memory, and that memory inspired him to want to investigate it further. The reason why that was important to me is because in the moment that he was, in my mind, dying, he was all by himself. He didn't have anybody else around him. There were no teachers. There were no Sangha members. It was just him. And in the midst of this moment, when all is going one way, he gets inspired to do something different. And I have in my own life, when I was struggling so much with the practice, this idea of closing my eyes and being tucked inside by myself was a very scary proposition to me. This idea of just being all by myself was a little overwhelming. And I always wanted, I could do things if I were doing it with somebody else. We're doing it together. It didn't matter how difficult it was. As long as I was doing it with a group of people, I had all this courage. But then when I had to do something by myself, and practice is very much a by ourselves kind of thing, then I start realizing that I had more and more and more fear around this uncertainty about if I know what I'm doing, if I'm doing it right, what if I'm doing it wrong, what's the best way to do it? And so devotional practices, rituals, devotional practice that we practice with alongside our contemplating or the Dhamma itself, it's what helps us stay on the path when we're not really sure what it is that we're doing, when we're not really sure how to do it. I remember some of us went to Cloud Mountain at this retreat recently. And what struck me was the bell that we use at Cloud Mountain is the same bell that has been at that place probably since they first opened their doors. It's been that bell there. And the first time I heard it on opening night, I remembered the opening nights of sitting there with Rodney at Cloud Mountain and that same bell. And there's something about hearing that bell, even this bell that we use here at Sims, it's the same bell. There's something about hearing the bell that adds within it a reassurance that I'm steady on this path. So when we say the refuges and the precepts at the beginning of a retreat, we're kind of like reminding ourselves of where we are and where we need to go. That all, I mean, people have all kinds of rituals that we're going to talk about later on in the month, but these rituals, when we do them, they kind of bring a level of surety to a practice that is in itself uncertain. It doesn't lend itself to being very I guess what I'm trying to say is most of the people I know, it does, we've been practicing 30 years and yet still students will come to me and say, well, am I doing it right? Is this how you're supposed to meditate? I can remember at my 3 month in the midst of, I mean, I've been practicing 30 years and I teach the Dhamma. And at this 3 month, I fell into this bout of doubt that I was not even sure that I should even continue. That's it. I even planned it all out, planned my escape. I was going to call my sister, some family member, and have them call IMS and say somebody died, because that usually gets us out quick, right? So somebody died and I need to get out of here because this is all, I'm faking it. It's not real. I can't do it. I was overwhelmed with doubt. And the only thing that saved me was that I could not remember anybody's phone number. All I had given up my phone, so I had to go down to the basement at IMS, and they have a little phone booth down there. And so you can go in that phone booth and you can dial on a rotary phone, an old style phone. But I couldn't remember anyone's number. I couldn't even remember my sister's number, and she's had the same number for 30 years. So I couldn't do it. I went to bed, and then later that night, I woke up thinking, it cannot be like this. It cannot be like this. And my devotion to practice took me back into the hall at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'm just sitting there deciding I'm going to sit here with my doubt. And eventually the doubt began to pass. It took a couple weeks before it actually passed. But the point that I'm saying is the devotion is what helped me stay with my surety. So I'm going to talk about one more thing. And then that'll be it. But the last thing that devotion helps us cut through is this basic habitual way that we go through life. We go through life in this habitual way, just moving through. And oftentimes we can bring our Dhamma into that same old thing. Just habit. And if we do it by habit, like, people can, and tell me, I don't, you know, a perfect example is with this, whole COVID situation. Long-term practitioners were freaking out when COVID first hit because they were so reactive. Somebody doesn't have a mask on and they're ready to take their heads off. Way back in the beginning. I mean, it's kind of like that now, but it's not quite as bad as it was. And yet, there was a sense that I've been doing this practice every day for 10, 15, 20 years. How come I'm having so much problems with it? And some of that is that we just do the practice by rote. We begin to think that my sitting every day is what's going to get me awakened. I sit every day. I go to Dhamma. I go to Sangha. I mean, what? I even chant the refuges and precepts. I chant the five recollections. I chant. I do my little devotion. Everything is good. But then how come if something happens, I freak out and I lose my, I won't say that word. I lose something. I lose it. How come that happens? And some of this is because devotion as a practice is not the end all beat all. It's not the end of the practice. You could think of it as the beginning of the practice. It's the doorway between ordinary world and this a sublime, hard to see tranquil world that the Buddha was pointing to. There's a doorway that we have to go through to understand that hard to see world. And the rituals get us to that door and through it. But what keeps us honest and what keeps us alive, what helps us see the Rin singing as prayer is dukkha. It's not the rituals. It's the dukkha that we are applying our rituals and our devotion around. And somehow when we're willing to be in relationship with dukkha, be in relationship with the impermanence, be in relationship to when I am stuck in my own self and when I'm not, be in relationship with things like the Four Noble Truths and the dependent origination, these things like the Dhamma kind of wisdom, then we can let the rituals and devotions go and experience the realness of the moment as it is. So it's not, let me just say metta, say metta, say metta, say metta so I can get past my anger. You say metta, say metta, say metta to calm down so you're willing to be with your anger. You're willing to feel that anger and not run away from it, not turn away from it, not pretend like you're really not angry. So oftentimes, if you use the metta as a habit or a pattern, then you kind of force that anger to go away, kind of shave it off. Oh, no, I'm not angry. And then we get lost. There's a, I think I told you, I don't know, I may have told this on Sunday, but my hairdresser is vegan and she got diagnosed with colon cancer and she wouldn't do any hair anymore. She just stopped talking to everybody and it took her about 6 months to get it together. And then she gave us a call and said she was going to start seeing us. So when I saw her, I said, "What happened? What happened to you?" She goes, "I've been mad." I'm like, "What are you mad about? I mean, I know I'd be sad and mad about getting cancer diagnosis, but what were you so angry about that you wouldn't even see any of your friends or anybody?" She said she was mad because she was vegan. She had been vegan her whole life. I was like, okay. What does that have to do with anything? But she was mad because she was vegan, and because she was vegan, she shouldn't have gotten colon cancer. She can't. She says she knows people that eat all kinds of junk and mess, and they don't have nothing going on with them. She eats all healthy and good. She won't even let us, you can't even, don't even think about bringing no fried chicken or something up in her house. And she was mad because all that efforting prevented her. She just could not see or accept that she could get colon cancer. And sometimes our devotion and rituals can become so ritualistic that we lose our ability to see that the ritual is not what awakens us. It's just to get us to look at dukkha, to look at impermanence, to look at emptiness in a way that we can free ourselves. So I want to leave you with this. Sacredness, devotional practices can bring with them a level of pleasantness, of awe and uplift. We were talking about this on Sunday, how uplifting some of these devotional practices can be. And that uplift can spark our curiosity and interest. It can allow us to take everything as sacred, including the things that are difficult. But never forget that this practice is about liberating the mind. And sacredness can bring us to the door of liberation. But dukkha and the realization of dukkha is what's going to take our understanding beyond sacredness, beyond anything we know right now, anything within the ordinary. It's dukkha, our willingness to be with it, that's going to take us to places beyond what we know. I thought I'd stop with a poem by Mary Oliver. Start with her and stop with her. She does have a way with the sacred. This is at the River Clarion. This is what she says. I don't know who God is exactly, but I'll tell you this. I was sitting in the river named Clarion on a water splashed stone, and all afternoon I listened to the voices of the river talking. Whenever the water struck the stone, it had something to say. And the water itself, and even the mosses trailing under the water. And slowly, slowly, very slowly, it became clear to me what they were saying. Said the river, I'm part of holiness. And I too, said the stone. And I too, whispered the moth beneath the water. I'd been to the river before a few times. Don't blame the river that nothing happened quickly. You don't hear such voices in an hour or a day. You don't hear them at all if selfhood has stuffed your ears. And it's difficult to hear anything anyway through all the traffic and ambition. Let's sit a moment. All righty. Well, thank you so much for your kind attention in this, especially tonight when it was so discombobulated. I'll see if there's a question or two, maybe one or two, if there is any. If there's not any, that's fine also. You can always, Dane. The question is metta what you'd use for an aversion to boredom? Yeah. So metta is actually for all and any type of aversion, any type of resistance. If you feel yourself pushing against reality, then metta is the antidote for that. And the metta that you're trying to access is not just staying with the phrases, but the phrases can help you settle so you can experience the dukkha of your resistance. Not to get the dukkha of your resistance to go away. So yeah, when you are bored, metta is one of the qualities that help you spark some interest. On long retreats, you can get really bored with the meditations day after day after day after day. And so oftentimes the teacher will instruct you to start your meditation with metta. And just metta, 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 until you settle down a little. All right. Yeah, see Sean or Bruce, one of you guys. Can you just unmute yourself? Can they just unmute themselves, Cheryl? You should be able to now.
Okay, I'm free.
Oh, you're free.
Free.
It's so weird hearing you in the room.
Okay. I can hear my feedback. So I have a problem with devotion.
Uh-huh.
From a past experience with a guru where I was a devotee and it was all devoted to the guru. Lost myself, not in the good sense of losing yourself. But I've really been thinking a lot about this as I've been listening to the talks. And I would say that I am dedicated. I'm dedicated to my practice.
Yes.
When my mind is crazy, like we were talking about in retreat, I've had that happen where I wanted to leave, escape. I'd rather go home and watch CNN than be at that retreat.
Yes, I totally know.
I was like, get me out of here. But what kept me there was my dedication to getting through that explosion in my mind that I knew was some kind of old, craggy, karmic thing that I wanted to not be trapped in anymore.
Yep.
But it wasn't devotion. And so I don't want to miss anything by eliminating devotion, but I feel really queasy around devotion.
Why do you think it wasn't devotion?
In that example?
Yeah, your example at the retreat.
I guess because I put devotion in this category of what I experienced when I was young by giving myself away totally to this other human being, guru,
yes,
that was not healthy, you know?
Well,
and so.
So you weren't given, so you, it wasn't devotion towards another human being, but you seem like you were pretty devoted to staying at the retreat and practicing through the dukkha.
Yeah,
you just devotion
yeah.
to yourself.
I guess it's the word. There's something about the word that just triggers something in me. But
it is. So I wouldn't call it, if I were you, I wouldn't call it devotion, because the word evokes this sense of worship.
Yes.
You know, but this is what I'm saying about Dhamma. It cannot be in the ordinary sense. Mm-hmm. So however you as an individual stay on the path and whatever you did that night, that place when you really wanted to leave, but you didn't. What helped you stay there is what I call devotion. Because in our ordinary sense of mind, no one in their right mind is going to stay at a place where they're suffering. If you tried to explain it to your friends, they're like, what the hell's wrong with you? You should have left. Why would you stay there and do all that? That's some kind of a cult. That's crazy making. But you understand that your staying there was not about just putting yourself through a lot of suffering, but coming to an understanding that would free your mind from that torment. Do you see that?
Yeah, I see that.
Yes.
So maybe it's more like I was devoted to myself.
That's correct.
Not to something or someone outside of myself, which is why Buddhism appealed to me. There's no worship of someone outside of myself.
That's right. In fact, yeah. I like Sharon Salzberg's book, Faith. On the cover of it, it says, trusting in your own experience. That's what faith is. It's not some belief in something that you don't know, but it's trusting in your own experience. And there's something about allowing our own experience to be sacred, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, good or bad, it doesn't matter how it is. This is the place I'm at right now, and this is where I want to practice. And that's it. And that's exactly what it sounded like you did to me. And I would call that devotion. Because it took something to get you to stay when you really wanted to get, if you would rather go home and listen to CNN, then there is surely some devotion there to get you to stay.
And I hated CNN, but I thought that would be heaven compared to what I was going through.
Well, that's what I'm trying to say. That's where this is what I'm saying, that devotion is the thing that gets us there, but the dukkha is what takes us into wisdom. Mm. And the devotion is what helped you stay there. So I thought that was quite beautiful.
I get it. It's just a reframe of that word.
Yep.
Devotion is going.
I think a lot of people have a hard time in Dhamma with the word faith, that they would prefer confidence or trust or something like that, because faith is too connected to being required to believe in something they didn't believe in. And so it's don't let the word steer you wrong, because it's just a word. It doesn't really mean anything. It's the expression of that word that you're looking for. So you can call it whatever you want, and don't ever feel like you have to call it devotional. Mm.
Yeah.
Great.
Thank you.
Is there another? You got a question? Go ahead.
I'm trying to say this briefly.
Okay.
It's something about the leap from ordinary requirements into that special thing. And I think of the example Carrie gave in her talk, where she was perceived as being a devoted daughter, where she was caring for another person in a very unpleasant situation. And the outside observer saw her as being an utterly devoted daughter, where I think her perception was, I just have to do this and it's a drag. I can't get around it. Do we need to create hardship for ourselves to get to that place of to get through to something other than ordinary experience?
I don't think so. See, this is why I believe devotion is just the beginning. I don't believe it's the thing that gets us over the hump. So I don't know. So they probably heard it because you put the mic there. Okay. So the dukkha dukkha, 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 dukkha. That is the path to liberation. We don't have to create dukkha. It's always with us every day. It doesn't take anything for dukkha to show up. What we need devotion for is to allow us to be willing to be with dukkha. Because dukkha in its ordinary understanding is a problem that needs to be fixed and we need to get away from it. But dukkha in our understanding as practitioners is the first noble truth that leads to awakening. So in order for us to go from the ordinary understanding of dukkha as a problem that needs to be fixed to dukkha as the first noble truth needs to be understood so that we can awaken, devotion, I think, is the doorway that helps us do that. And so devotion for some people will look like a lot of vowing and recitations and mantras and, you know, whatever's going to help us stay with the dukkha. Someone like me, I do a lot of bowing and recitations and whatnot. But if you think about Sean, her devotion is the stick-to-itiveness in the midst of that dukkha, which is what Carrie was pointing to. Even though somebody could call it that way, perceive it that way, and she may not have thought it that way, her, what gives her the capacity to stay in a difficult situation is her practice and her devotion to practice. Do you see that? That's what it is. That's why I think the devotions and the rituals are the doorway, and they only get us. If you hold the devotion itself only, then after a while, that devotion is going to get a little boring because it's not going to really help you. I mean, unless you start looking at the dukkha, it's devotion is going to get a little boring. Anyway, so we're going to talk more on this. I'll think of some questions that we can talk about to kind of open up this a little bit next week.